Exactly. That's what we're going to spend the time after lunch talking about, exactly what an organization like this might do in terms of services. And I just All right. Well, first of all, let me separate myself from this, since it isn't necessarily me that would be expected. My role here, as it was last time, is to counsel you. Steve and his group have identified us as a resource that can help you deal with strategy. We have told Steve and his group that the first point of strategy is organization. That you can all come together and set up this brilliant strategy, and as soon as there's an argument that disappears, you're going to look worse than if you didn't get together in the first place. It's really not possible for me at this time to say what such an organization might cost, because I think we as a group have to discuss what we exactly want the organization to do. And that's what we want to spend the time after lunch doing. To set up such an organization, to get through those initial phases, to do the research, to do the scenarios and some of the other things, we can probably get a pretty rough idea as we list those and see what kind of consensus there is around those issues, what that might cost. And we estimate that it would probably take from now till the first of the year to go through those organizing phases and to get various ones of you to be able to get commitments from your organization to join. Now, as far as the money is concerned, operate a coalition, I would say that that money, some of it certainly should come from the member organizations. Very often the pattern on this has been that the member organizations contribute something out of their budget and then refer the coalition organization, give it an introduction to major funding sources that are among its members. And that generally seems to be the pattern lately, rather than just funding it straight out of the budget to the member organizations. Particularly, we're talking here about a $1 billion industry, multi-billion-dollar industry. Any money that comes to a coalition through your organization is only an addition to the dues of your members anyway. And so most often, it's been the pattern to identify key, larger, usually corporations that have an interest in this and that have already got mechanisms for funding, foundations or annual contributions. Oh, I think absolutely they would have to. I think they would absolutely have to. For most things, yes. Absolutely. The key question, and the reason I started out with this without going into a great deal of detail, which we will do after lunch, is that I think it's important for all of you to discuss exactly the issue that we're on. Because when you scrape all the rest of it away, hell, listen, I could have given you a strategy last time. I told you that. That's what I do for a living. I could give you a strategy today, but it would be my strategy. It would be an expert strategy, so-called expert in quotes. That is not going to carry the day. Whatever is done that's effective on this issue has to rise out of you, out of your organizations, and out of your members. Unless we can get the last member out there to understand it and be with us, the chances of shooting ourselves in the foot are about 90%. So the key issue is whether American agricultural institutions are ready to come together, to think broadly, and to recognize this threat. And that's where I started with that, because there's no sense beating around the bush. Let's get down to the roots. Yeah, my thought, my understanding of what was a little bit different, I guess, than yours. I thought you were going to give us, you were going to help us, and tell us what the strategy was going to be, because we pretty much recognized that while we were experts in production agriculture, we were not experts in agriculture. therefore we want to really more for you to tell us we're giving you feedback. But I thought it was coming from you rather than, you know, get us from you. So we talked about that last time, we talked about this committee. The strategy really has to come from you. And even if you can agree to come together and work on this issue as an entity, certainly, I would hope that we or someone like us with this expertise would be available to guide you through the strategy. But you have to really be absolutely, totally comfortable and have ownership in that strategy. Because if you don't, you can't take it back to your organizations and sell it, and you probably cannot act on it in a natural way. And our experience is that if you can't do that, I can show you a lot of cases where strategy has been purchased, like buying a car or buying printing, and the people who purchased it don't really understand it or have a gut feeling of it, and the minute you're in the crossfire, it just disappears. Besides, the issues here, the potential compromises, the potential advantages that you have are going to come from your experiences. And those are the guts of what's happening. That really ought to rise from you. First of all, let's assume they do know that you're meeting. Let's assume they didn't, or that somehow setting up a different kind of coordinating body might be viewed by them as something they could use. First of all, I don't think there's very much they're doing. There's very much they could do that they aren't doing now within the level of their ability to get resources and get commitment of members. If this were of use to them in any way, it's something that they already have. In other words, all they could say about this new group was, gee, you know, they're scared, they're coming together. That's why we propose that this not be a great activist organization. This be, in fact, coordinating kind of an educational and research group. If anything, we would have an answer, or whatever that means, to their statement that this showed that anybody was running scared.
Through these couple of these polls here very quickly, Hugh. This one was done by this, I'm not sure what NOP stands for, but it was commissioned by the General Election Coordinating Committee on Animal Protection. So it was done by an animal welfare kind of group over there. And it was to try and analyze what the probably attitudes in a range of animal-related issues, and specifically to measure the extent to which people could be persuaded to switch their vote on the basis of animal protection. The other survey I have is one National Farmers Union did with a completely different a group that they surveyed. And while the data is pretty similar in the two, the conclusions are just totally the opposite, which I thought was interesting. But they said town dwellers were stronger in their support than country dwellers, but the differences between them weren't very great. Said the idea of animal rights being supported only by ignorant townies is clearly not supported by the evidence of this survey. But when they asked which of these issues are important to you, at least from a political standpoint or as far as who you'd vote for, many things. They said that increasing the controls on factory farming came up very high, but there were so many things that above it, politically, banning the use of lead and petrol, reducing experiments on animals, reintroducing grammar schools, banning fox hunting, building more nuclear power stations, allowing all shops to open on Sundays was more important to people than factory farming. And then factory farming came in with about a quarter of the people saying that that would be of interest to them. but only 5% said they'd switched their votes as a result of that. And it was interesting to note that the Labour Party over there in this last election had factory farming as part of their platform. And it's also curious to note that they so soundly lost the election. Just over half the respondents, 56%, disapproved of battery cages, and 40% supported a legal ban on them. But there was strong support for changing law to ensure that battery hens can always stretch their wings. And you have all that information, but then when they get down, I don't guess it's in this survey, it was in the other survey, National Farmers Union survey, they started talking about economics, where people said that they were very much concerned in the way, for example, that hens are raised in battery cages. They asked about how much extra they'd pay for the eggs. And I think a majority of those that were concerned said they'd pay 10 pence extra. But when it got to the point where they, to how much eggs cost more over there, free-range eggs cost almost twice as much is what eggs from battery cage situations do over there. And there's very few people that are willing to pay that. The survey bore that out, and it's kind of like a health food approach that wasn't very successful here. I asked my wife about that, and she said, sure, I'm concerned about those hens being raised in those battery cages. And I said, well, those eggs over there cost almost twice as much per dozen, and they're dirty. And she said, well, I'm not going to pay more for dirty eggs. And I said, but, you know, you got to reconcile this problem. Are you concerned about the hens? And she said, just don't tell me how the hens are raised. I want my eggs clean. So I think that's, even though that's not a scientific example by any means, from what I've seen in these surveys and talked to people over there, I think it's pretty, a common example of what you find with people. This one was done with people, the rural people on one hand, they surveyed them separately, the rural people and then people in London, and they put them together. They said a tiny minority are critical of farming, citing main reasons for this as being farmers moaning about their supposed poverty. So I thought some things are the same world over, I guess. The vast majority consider that farmers do care fairly well for their animals, although half are aware of allegations of poor treatment, particularly in the case of battery hens. A mere 6% hold critical views of farmers' treatment of animals. Even respondents who like to ban intensive farming are not particularly inclined to say that farmers do not treat their animals well. Clearly, this is a problem with only a small minority of the farmers. And most people, 63%, say they would be willing to pay more for food if this meant that animals would be better cared for. However, hardly any of the respondents, 2%, offer as much as farmers are estimated to need. For example, 50 to 60 pence extra per dozen eggs. And most, 43%, would only give up 10 pence. So that was very interesting. The majority, 90%, consider that farmers treat their animals at least fairly well. 36% think the animals are treated very well by farmers, and only 6% felt that there's cause for complaint. So the National Farmers Union was thinking about mounting a huge campaign in that country, and after this survey, they're questioning whether they should do anything. They have, like I said, put together some videotapes they're showing on TV there, and they put together this document. I'll pass this around. It's really pretty good. It's pretty well done, and it talks about really the same kind of things that we've been saying. So I'll pass that around. Anyone have any questions?
Do they have any group corresponding to this group?
Not really. In fact, it seemed like there was more infighting. Like I said, the MLC was highly critical of what NFU was doing, and NFU was critical of what MLC was doing, and I went all the way down the line like that, it seemed like. So I guess not. I don't even know if they've attempted it. I've not heard of them all. Except for the government supported Farm Animal Welfare Council.
Thank you so much, David. If you do have any additional questions, you're going to be around the rest of the day that they can corner you afterwards and get these individual questions. Pat, let's continue.
I want to write some things up over here so we can all see it and know exactly those of you who were here last night. those people maybe weren't, it ought to be relatively clear that the way that my group and I function is not to beat around the bush. And this morning was an example of what I consider not beating around the bush. You've had three meetings. These three meetings have tended to settle on the same kind of issues. So when we were asked to come and talk to you about how you might get a strategy going, and we looked at that issue, we see it about like this. That the key, the number one point, and the key to the whole thing is coordination. Last time I talked about speaking with one clear voice. And we really believe, from our experience, our rather substantial experience, I think I don't know how we compare it. We've been involved in a lot of issues. We have substantial experience, and our experience tells us that this is where issues either get you down or you're able to handle them, right here. The second key is the actual strategy. Let's call it the message that is communicated to the public, to legislators, to whoever the heck else gets involved. The third thing is somebody has to do it. And that's one of the key issues. And in coalition building, you sort of have three positions. You might diagram them like this. First up here, you have the position where the member organizations carry out all the activities, and the coalition becomes the coordinating body somehow. And then you have others where you go completely the other way, and you have a staff in the organization, and it does everything, and the coalition members just sort of ratify what it's doing. Those are what I would consider the extremes. The third possibility, and the only one that we have ever found to work, is a combination, is a combo of those two. And I mean that sincerely. If you have all the money in the world, we find that this does not work very well when you've got a group of people that are concerned about an issue. Because there are all kinds of discussions here about competition between this thing that's been set up and what you've got existing. On the other hand, this doesn't work either, in our experience, because if the member organizations do everything, the trouble is that Joe Smith from member organization A, that you're counting on to do a specific job at a specific time, suddenly is overrun with some immediate responsibility, some emergency in his or her own job, and you've got a problem. So our experience is a combination kind of an organization where you have both members active plus some coordinating entity. And that's what I was essentially talking about this morning. The fourth is that you have to fund whatever you're going to do. Now, I worked with agriculture groups before. You're a goddamn tight bunch, in my experience. Okay? Nobody here is going to disagree with that. It's tough getting a buck out of everybody to do this. And this may be one of your major problems on animal rights, because here's why. We've already agreed animal rights is a continuing issue. It isn't going to go away. That means we're looking at a series of years over which we have to be prepared to be patient and work along on it. Secondly, it's a national issue. It's not one that's just limited to certain areas. And I strongly believe, and I have no research for this, it's a hunch, but I think others of you will probably agree with this. I strongly believe that the animal rights people are going to find an Achilles heel out in the state legislatures. I really believe that. And when they do, boy, that's tough. You know, there's only one Capitol Hill, but damn it, there's 50 state legislatures. So it's a national issue. That means there isn't any place we can really ignore. thirdly, it's such a broad issue. It not only is a latent or emerging issue by itself, but it also benefits from all this fallout from past issues. Plus, we already know that it has its component of the actual treatment of animals, the actual liberationist, if you will. It has the vegetarian approach. It has the chemical approach. It has the idea of using experimental animals and then leading from that into farm animals. So you've already got a broad range of issues. And you're dealing with a multi-billion dollar industry. So I would be less than professional if I came here and said, oh, put up a few bucks and we can take care of this. I mean, the realities are it's going to cost money. And over a period of years, it's going to be a substantial amount. Now, whether that money is counted in members' activities, which you, in essence, are paying for out of your own budget because you don't do something else, you do this instead, or whether it's in some coordinating entity that does a few things or probably a combination of those, it's going to cost some money. And I just want to be very upfront with all of you so that you don't keep coming together like this and thinking that somehow by meeting here at the Farm Bureau and getting back in touch with one another, that it's going to go away. We're playing hardball. And I'm not going to say any more. I hope I've made that point. Let me share with you what your task force, your Committee on Public Relations, and since this essentially is a public relations issue, and in case there's any disagreement on that, let me just go back to the Tylenol case that we discussed this morning. When the Tylenol issue was finally settled and the company could look back at it, the chairman of the company said, this, he said, is an indication of where organizations are in the modern world. He said the most important single function they have is their public relationships. Because he says, as I looked around my company when the Tylenol scare hit, I looked at everybody that I, as the boss, could call on to deal with this. He said, I had one department that could deal with this. That was public relations. It's my production people couldn't help, my lawyer couldn't help, my personnel people couldn't help. I have a hunch that's what we're talking about here, and so essentially this whole issue is a public relations issue. Now, your committee identified six areas of concern that ought to be dealt with. The first one was an alert or readiness system. The second one was a legislative watch. The third one was some opinion research and general surveillance of where the issue is on the public's agenda. The next one was to set up a two-way communications network within the group here, and with particularly with any outsiders that we can get to join the coalition who have no stake in agriculture, at least as producers. Let's see, where are we here? The next one was a public education program, and that includes the work with schools. And let's see, finally, was some way of responding to emergencies directly. Not to be confused with an alert or readiness system, which is essentially having a strategy on it, letting those of you know that something just happened in Iowa and it may happen in your state. Well, I don't know how you feel about those. They jive pretty well with what we talked about last time and what I knew about your activities to date. But is there any discussion about that? Is there something else that the committee should have put on there that they didn't, or something that isn't so important? By the way, No, it's not, but can you read my writing there? Okay. All right, well, if that looks like... That looks like the things that this group wants to carry out. And if you'll just bear with me a minute longer, in my hunch, that the first thing you have to do is to organize to do this. Let me see the tools that we feel are necessary in order to make this happen. Now, there's things we can do right now that ideally, out of this meeting would come some kind of an agreement, one way or another, to do in a coordinated way. The first thing is some data gathering. Now, if we had all the money in the world, I could put up a list, and I know you could, of 20 different types of data we'd love to gather because it would be helpful to have. To get started, our hunch is that there are two particular pieces of data that will be the most useful. The first thing is some real attitude research among actual farm groups. So I think it's important, and you can argue this both ways. We feel that it's important to know the particular state of knowledge or ignorance of the members of the agricultural community across the country on this issue. A lot of people, I've discussed this with many of you, a lot of them say, oh hell, they're all aware of this. And others say, they don't know very much about it. The reason it's important to know that is because, as I said today, the first job is obviously to educate the troops. You can't educate the troops unless you know exactly where they are. And this kind of a study, we estimated that we probably ought to survey, we ought to get about 2,000 responses from producers in the United States. Now, the way to do that most cost effectively is to do basically a mail questionnaire, because that's least expensive, but then to double check the mail questionnaire with a telephone survey. So if we were going to try and get 2,000 responses on an issue this hot, we assumed that a mailing of about 5,000 would get us 2,000 responses, except that we would phone about 200. So 2,000 responses, 1,800 of them would be mail replies, and 200 of them would be telephone. And of course, we use the phone responses to check the accuracy of the mail responses, since they are the least accurate research method. Now, from that, the way that would be done would be by taking the producer groups who are in this coalition and getting from you a weighted sample picked at random of your membership by number of members. In other words, if the pork producers represent 10% of the members of this coalition, I'm sorry, how about the members of your organizations, then 200, well, you need about 5,000 names in order to get 2,000 responses. So 500 names then picked at random would come from pork producers and so on. I mean, obvious method. But at least then we have a weighted sample of the organizations that are in the coalition that we would know where your folks stand. Now, there's another way to do that. If we go to this model of the members doing it, we or someone could come up with the method and the questionnaire and work with each of you, and you could work it on a sampling of your own members. My hunch is that we would get better, unbiased data if it's done by some third-party group, because members are more apt to write on the bottom, yeah, this is great, but why haven't you, and then ride their hobby horse. And they may have other issues at stake. But it seems to us, and I went into some detail on that just to show you that what I'm talking about isn't something we just made up, but we have pretty good detail to back it up. The second thing that's necessary, in our opinion, is a study of where agribusiness executives are on this issue. Now, why do I say that? Two reasons. And I'm talking now all the way from presidents of chemical companies and equipment manufacturers down to dealers. with stops in between. And I'm talking only about executives. At this point, let's not worry about how the average worker in John Deere's factory feels. We can get to them later, and they'll be valuable allies. The reason we're going after this audience, our key to the strategy. First, this activity, which is going to cost money, is going to have to be funded, and if recent history is a guide, that's where a hell of a lot of the funding is going to have to come from. So let's find out where they are on the issue. Secondly, because they are in a different relationship to the American public than the producers are, their support and participation in this issue gives us a different angle on the American public. I mean, it's quite one thing to have farm groups saying something, and it's quite something else to have the executives at John Deere or some chemical, pick your company. And that's two different angles for the American public. So if we can find out where they are on the issue, find out what they need to know, then we can quickly, this organization, quickly get them the information and bring them up to snuff and get them on board in a very short period of time, provided we first take the trouble to find out where they are. Secondly, incidentally, notice that at the beginning, we are not suggesting any public research. I don't think we're ready for that yet. I don't think it would really be helpful now. Changing so fast anyway. Nor are we quite yet suggesting, as I did last time, some real infiltration into the opposition to find out where they are. In gathering more data and in talking to just our own contacts within that other group, it turns out that we probably know as much about what they're doing right now as they know. What we don't know is the depth of their commitment and how far they are willing to go. And I'd rather not research that at this time because it's premature. Okay, the second step is to do some strategic planning. Now, strategic planning takes, I think, the following form here. First of all, based on the information that we already have available, that many of you have gathered and contributed, this group ought to do some scenarios, or have done for it some scenarios, maybe two or three or four scenarios. Now, a scenario is, you probably know, is just a planning tool in which you assume that something happens, and then you carry that out logically, sort of like writing a short story. It's probably the most realistic planning tool that we have available to us for issues. So you start out assuming, for example, that the animal rights people decide to mount picket campaigns at farms in six states. And then you just carry that out and say, exactly what would happen? What would they have to do to make this happen? What would we have to do to respond to it? What would their likely message to the public be? What mechanisms would they use to attract opinion leaders and media to cover it? And then what would we have to do to counter this, to respond to it, to cut it off? If you do two or three of those, picking various approaches, it doesn't take you very long to see exactly what you need in the way of messages, tools, man and woman power, and so forth. So the first thing to do would be to generate some scenarios. And then, most importantly, after a committee or a council or somebody generates those, to use those as tremendous educational advices among all of us. In other words, circulate them to everybody in this group, and you in turn recirculate them to key people in your organization, so that within a month, a few thousand people, key people in agriculture around the country, have had a chance to look at an actual situation. I mean, it's obviously fiction, but it's written like an actual situation. And so a few thousand people have then had a chance to send us, in this coordinating group, their ideas. They don't think this is a good idea. They doubt that the opposition would do that, and here's their reason why. In other words, very quickly, we have involved the best brains in agriculture across the country in participating in this process. And two heads are far better than one when you're dealing with this kind of stuff. Okay, so scenarios is a planning tool, it's also a terrific educational device, and it's a coordinating device. It gets us all thinking along similar lines. Secondly,
we've got a problem, in our opinion, that we can solve somewhat, well, I don't want to say quickly, but that we can solve in this whole area of semantics, or what we call psychological modeling. Never mind all this professional public relations jargon, but that's the shortest way to write it up there. I spoke with the pork producers' state leadership at their recent meeting, and a fellow there who's been in that field for a long time picked me up on this point at the end. He said, you know, he said, we had everything going for us. He says, we used to call where we raised the hog, we used to call them pig parties. He says, now we talk about raising them in confinement. He says, you made a hell of a mistake, didn't you? The only thing I could say to him is, yeah, you're absolutely right. I wonder if we look at the language of our industry in general, if we can't talk about it and see if we can get some agreement on some terminology that will just reshape this issue. Don't for a minute think that this is just little tinkering. The words you use to describe the issue are everything. They are literally everything. You can make an issue out of nothing, or you can kill an issue with the right words. So if we could do some work on semantics, including, by the way, what the name of the coordinating entity ought to be. And that's not an easy name to choose. What should this coordinating entity be called? It deserves some time and attention. Our firm, one of the things that we do, we're very sensitive to this, is one of the things that we do is to apply behavioral science to the names of organizations. We've named a lot of store chains and universities, and you may be wearing some shirts here that we've named. And there's a very technical process for doing this. It's worth putting this name through that kind of process and working on the semantics and doing a psychological model. What a psychological model is to take the kind of things we found in the scenario after we get the feedback from that, and then run those through a very consuming logical test. Let me give you an example. If the animal rights people say, raising veal raising veal in individual units is wrong because, if that's what they say, then how should we answer that? Well, maybe there are three answers to this. So over here we write down what they say, and then here we write down three answers. And then in the next column we write down how would they be apt to respond to our answer. And then in the next column, how would we respond to their response? And after you carry that out five or six times, you have pretty well exhausted the potential debate back and forth. Now, it's well worth doing, because that means there are very few surprises for you out there once you've gone through this exercise. You know about what they're going to say, and if they say something, you know what to say back to them. It's just applying some good science instead of shooting from the hip. That's well worth doing to get going. Thirdly, a surveillance model ought to be established as part of a strategic plan. When do we know that this has become a hot enough issue that certain kinds of effort ought to be expended in certain directions? The only way that we know to find that out is with a surveillance model. Now, in the materials that were handed out this morning, there is a surveillance model. The one that we most often use involves surveying media coverage, looking at political exposure, how many bills have been entered, how many speeches have politicians given, or have they been quoted in the paper, looking at grassroots attention, have there been rallies, is somebody speaking to the Kiwanis Club, that kind of thing. Looking at academic interest, is anybody writing a thesis on this topic now? Has it become hot enough for that? Have some students at universities gotten onto the issue? That's usually a pretty good indicator. Finally, some kind of a profile of the leaders and members of the opposition groups, which you can gather over time as they expose themselves more. some kind of a method ought to be set up. A surveillance model ought to be agreed upon by this group that we would set up an actual indicator. And when we get a certain number of responses on the indicator, then automatically at that point, boom, Plan A goes into effect. And this model ought to be turned into a system. Now here is another example of where members' activity, and particularly grassroots member activity, can be very helpful. Certainly with many of you have offices or chapters or state organizations all around the country. It shouldn't be too difficult, we've done this on other occasions, to identify people in each of those areas that will read the local paper and send us what's happening, that will go tear off the local bulletin board the announcement of the latest meeting of the animal rights group, that will listen to the radio talk shows, that kind of stuff. Many of you, of course, have clip services in the more obvious ways. It should be easy to set up a legislative watch so we know what bills are being entered. I think this might be the way that we give some of those very concerned folks out in the grassroots who are getting frustrated by all this something that they could do, something active they could do that isn't at the same time going to build the issue. It's at least one thing that a lot of them, I think, would be willing to do. We've had pretty good experience with them. The third thing is that an activity plan is needed. And the activity plan, or the plan, the program, whatever you want to call it, the actual working program that we're all going to follow, has to come out of the data gathering and the strategic planning. Now, the activity plan has to include goals, long-term goals, and short-range, very measurable objectives. I think this thing has to be measurable and accountable at every step of the way. I see this activity plan or program, and it also has to have one other thing. It has to have very careful division of labor. In other words, the question up here will be answered right here. Because when you discover what has to be done to deal with the issue and the opposition, you quickly know where you can divide up the work. I see this activity being done by a planning and research committee, if you will, from among this group, or maybe better yet, from folks that are in your organizations back home who may be your public relations specialists, perhaps research professionals. I see a group of them working with council to come up with an actual activity plan and program, specific things to do. But notice that we feel strongly that has to come after some data gathering and after some strategic planning. We have a method, I think I talked a little bit about it last time, the meat paper planning, that is very, very specific, both public by public, and that's what we would suggest. Fourthly, this coordinating organization needs a capabilities audit of each organization, of each member organization. In other words, we need